At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Well, it's a beautiful day in New York, and starting tomorrow, it will rain until Tuesday.
Oh, seriously?
Yes.
I never look at the weather app. You know those people who it starts raining at 4 and they have an umbrella? That's never me.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm always ill-prepared for the rain. Also, like, April showers? Okay, but bring the flowers. We don't want no more rain. Bring me the summer.
Oh, I thought you meant weed.
I've always got those flowers.
Hello, Down Bitches!
Hello, babies! How you doing, babies, you sweet little angels? I've been thinking of you all day, my little sugar plum fairies.
Well, welcome to I Think Not, where sometimes Joey has a stroke on the mic, and everything is okay!
Does anybody smell toast?
I am one of your hosts, Ellen Marsh, and across from me is old blue eyes over there, Joey Taranto.
Sup, ladies?
And you are here at I Think Not, the podcast where we dissect, make fun of, recap all of your favorite true crime TV shows, episode by episode, and this month is no exception. We're talking American Greed, y'all.
Ellen, you have to say it like the narrator.
American Greed!
He has had minimum 2 lines of coke every time he gets in the booth to record.
Either that or 25 Celsiuses.
Which probably is worse, not gonna lie.
Yep.
We're here every week bringing you all of this true crime content, but guess what? There is more. Yes, there is. There is more ridiculousness to be had on our Patreon. And speaking of our Patreon, we do have a gift box subscription that just rolled out, and people are posting all of their unboxing videos of the Down Bitch Hotel Resort and Spa. Have you loved watching them, Joey?
They look amazing. You and Harris did such an amazing job on those boxes. They are really thought out. They are curated to within an inch of their lives. It's a work of art. I'm very proud of you.
Thank you. It was really fun. We basically curated this box, and every box will have a different theme. And this was sort of like a spa in a box. We had a Down Bitch company make us a body butter. We sourced right within our community for the embroidery and all of the beautiful items. So if you haven't taken a look, go ahead and look on our socials. No pressure at all. It is just one little way for us to extend the fun and just have a laugh together. So check out the Down Bitch Hotel and Spa. It's all very Beverly Hills Hotel inspired with banana leaves and green soothing colors. We really did have a blast.
And just for $5 a month, you get 4 bonus episodes a month, 3 of an alternative series that we cover, and our 4th episode, which is always a true crime adjacent show, which is the stuff of my nightmares called Love After Lockup.
There are so many episodes. If you want to hang out with us a little bit more, go ahead and check it out. And if you don't want to, I totally understand. I'm not mad at you at all, because we can be loud. We can be a lot sometimes. Do you think we're a lot?
Speak for yourself.
You do too much. And when I say you, I mean me. Shall we get to the episode, Joey?
Yes.
American Greed! Season 9, Episode 2, The Playboy of Indiana.
In this episode of American Greed, Indianapolis businessman Tim Durham lived like a Hollywood playboy.
Tim liked flash. He liked car companies and cigar bars and ultra lounges and yachts.
He dates models, drives super exotic cars.
I had a nail in the tire, cost $22,000.
And owns a $6 million yacht.
I mean, I like material things, absolutely. I think that's what drives the American economy. I think everybody's materialistic.
Durham's ambition? To be the world's richest man.
At the end of the day, when I breathe my last breath, I'd like to be worth more than anyone else in the world.
But this master of the universe perverts Midwestern values by stealing $200 million from blue-collar workers, farmers, firemen, school bus drivers.
And I just would like to ask him, was it worth it? Where you are now, was it really? Would you do it again?
Well, y'all, immediately we are getting a crossover with American Greed and Playboy Murders because we have a real-life Playboy bunny here. Her name is Megan Hauserman. That's how you need to pronounce it.
Right. That's the proper German.
You Americans butcher the French niche reference. Yeah, you don't want to say Hauserman. It's Hauserman.
Yeah.
And she was a Playboy bunny in 2006 and 2007. She's also a reality TV star as she was on Beauty and the Geek, a show I've never heard of, but I have to give it to them. That is an excellent play on words.
There are so many reality shows. Well, I was sitting there wondering where the heck I knew her from, and then she finally says it. She was on VH1's Rock of Love, and I remember that show. I mean, the mid-aughts was an amazing time for reality TV shows. It was really life-changing. Do you remember that show? Did you watch it?
No. I was too busy being gay.
They were like, let's take this absolutely bald-ass rocker who 100% covers his bald-ass head with a scarf and long hair to make it seem like he has a full head of hair.
Mm-hmm.
And you know that guy, the lead singer of Poison. What's his name? Bret Michaels?
Yep.
And make sure he's wearing that scarf so he looks hot. Put a bunch of eyeliner on him and have women literally fight and spit on each other over him. Listen, honey, every thorn has a rose. There is a lid for every pot.
Every thorn has a rose?
Yeah.
Every thorn has its rose.
Yeah, every thorn has a rose. Absolutely. I meant it the way I said it.
Well, she was on more than that. She was on VH1 I Love Money. She even had her own show called Megan Wants a Millionaire. I have no idea who this woman is. I didn't watch any of those shows. I was busy doing drugs and dancing to Darude Sandstorm.
In the summer of 2007, Megan gets a call from her modeling agency. But it's not her typical gig. The client isn't a fashion photographer or film director. He's an Indiana businessman named Tim Durham.
And Tim contacted the agency saying that he was having a big 44th birthday party in which he wanted to do as a Playboy-style mansion theme.
So 25 women are flown first class to Indianapolis from L.A.
We're going to be there next week. Can't wait.
They are picked up in Rolls Royces, and they're told your destination is mysterious. Now, listen, if I was one of these 25 women, I would be like, nope, nope, nope. There will be no mystery in this destination. You're going to give me every detailed itinerary of who, what, when, where, and why. Because in the words of Radiohead, I want no surprises.
Well, I didn't know that they had so many McDonald's cars, honestly. I just thought my dad had a McDonald's car. Also, what is so pivotal about 44? Don't you want to round it up, blow it out at 45? He's like, no, no, no. I really need the white glove service for my 44th birthday. It has to happen. I have to fly women. I want big-breasted beauties for my 44th. Why? That just seemed such a silly, odd, and just like random number to really splash out on.
I mean, maybe it's the alliteration of 44, or we will find out later what kind of man this guy is.
Sure.
Now we get Tim Durham's backstory. He grew up in Seymour, Indianapolis.
I know Seymour's the greatest.
I'm sorry. I had to. Blame the ADHD. Now, Seymour's claim to fame, it's John the Cougar Mellencamp. I did not see him on my bingo card today.
Honestly, they tell us that he wrote a song called Seymour, inspired by the town Seymour. If you backed up a truck full of money to my house, I could not hum a John Cougar Mellencamp song.
Yes, you could.
What?
Little ditty about Jack and Diane.
Okay. I didn't know that was his.
My favorite is this.
Okay, I didn't know. Of course I know those songs. I didn't know they belonged to him. But I guess they grew up together or knew each other or grew up in the same town or they lived across the street. Okay.
Yeah.
It was so inconsequential to the episode and what's happening here.
Did you give John Mellencamp permission to use your nickname?
Oh, which nickname? I have so many.
The Cougar.
Oh, no. I thought you were going to call me Cuntface. I didn't.
John the Cuntface Mellencamp just doesn't have the same ring to it.
So we see an interview with him from 2007.
I didn't come from, you know, a wealthy background. You know, my dad is a dentist. He, you know, I think he drove a Honda for, I don't know, 15 years, you know. And he said, this is good enough. I can get my golf clubs in the bag and that's really all you need in life. And that was his philosophy.
I would never call a dentist middle class. I mean, you look at a dentist and they charge you $1,000. Like, dentists make a lot of money. I regret all of my decisions in terms of what I've done in my life, because had I known that fiddling with people's mouths would be so lucrative, I definitely would have made some other decisions in my life. That is not a lot of money. A dentist makes a good living.
They do, but can I just tell you something? As a former makeup artist, I would imagine as a dentist, it's the same. When people are just staring up at you with their mouth open and they're like, I just want to slap their face.
Do you know I had the same dentist for like 10 years and I told the same joke for 10 years. I would get in the chair and he would say, open up. And I'd go, well, I guess a lot of the source of my trauma was from my dad. And he would laugh every time. I was like, Dr. Allen, I've used the same joke for 10 years. But then I thought about my career, and that's pretty much where I've landed here with you beautiful people of I Think Not. Thanks for being here.
Congratulations. Well, the thing about Tim is he wanted more. He wanted wealth. He went to law school where he showed up in a BMW. They don't tell us how he acquired this BMW. I'm assuming he leased it. But he graduates and immediately gets a job at a very highly regarded firm in Indianapolis called, wait for it, Ice Miller. Ice Miller sounds like the rap name of an old out-of-touch white man who named himself that as a joke, a man who probably doesn't wipe his butt because he thinks it's gay. You know what I'm saying?
Not that last part, but I'm gonna go with it. But yeah, what's your rap name? My name is Ice Miller.
And I'm a lawyer. I opened up a firm in Indianapolis. And you know what? I know a couple guys.
Greg Andrews is here, and he's from the Indianapolis Business Journal, and I really feel like this interview probably caught him by surprise because he didn't have even a moment to run a comb through his hair.
Nope.
I'm sure he's a very nice person, but he's like, oh, I didn't expect you guys. I was just finishing my Panera Bread lunch, and we could do the interview now.
I know some people who worked with him at Ice Miller, and he was certainly well-regarded, viewed as ambitious, very smart. So, there were no signs of sort of an underside of Tim Durham at that point. He was seemed to be on a very traditional, successful path.
This man had ambition. He had goals, but his goal was just to make money, which that's a weird goal. Like, everyone wants success and wants to be comfortable, but he's like, I don't care what I'm doing. I just want to make money. He didn't have any goals beyond that. Did you think that was weird?
I mean, here's the thing. I think people truly underestimate the idea that money does not make you happy.
Yeah.
It truly does not. We know some people with a lot of money who are absolutely miserable.
And horrible. That was his goal, though. Could you imagine if someone was like, what's your goal? Make money. It's not like to leave the world a better place or to be a lawyer or a doctor or to help people. Just whatever it takes to make money, I'm going to do it. I don't know. I guess I just can't put my brain there.
Well, we don't think like that.
Yeah, I guess so.
So Tim marries a woman named Joan Servas, who was the daughter of Bert Servas, a very powerful local city councilman. What the fuck am I saying?
A councilman? What are you? Well, I'm a councilman and my brother is a motorist.
I am a man who manages and oversees councils. I'm a councilman.
I am a councilman, and I use my brother for his motorist skills.
It's quite true. And Bert was also a quite accomplished businessman.
He was.
We are told that Bert is
the master of the leveraged buyout.
What does that mean? Explain it to me like I'm five.
Using debt to buy companies and then working to fix them and flip them for a profit.
Okay, I'm back. I understand now.
I just was like, isn't that Edward from Pretty Woman?
Oh my God, Ellen.
Did you say that?
Literally. I was like, it's the man that Julia Roberts turns him into. So you don't build anything, you don't make anything.
Right, but that's what he did. He like bought companies and like sold them off.
I would imagine though that that kind of work is deeply satisfying because what they would do is get a company that was in trouble, build it up, and then sell it off and make a bunch of money off of it. And I could see how that would be like, fuck yeah, I did that. I can see how that would be satisfying. A lot of work.
I don't think that that was the goal. I think that money was the goal. But Bert taught Tim this whole business of doing this company. What was it called? Leveraging company? Leveraging the company's company?
Debt leverage. Leverage this pussy.
I don't understand money. Is money real? Like, are dollars real? Like, are there billions of actual paper dollars? I don't understand it. Anyway.
So Tim buys his first company. It's called Lake City Forge, which sounds like a band where, like, they're hanging off the edge of the stage barefoot and smoking a joint. I don't know, like Dave Matthews.
Right.
And this company is based in Michigan. So he borrowed a bunch of money to acquire it, and then he ended up making a cool 14, 15 million profit on it. Okay. So we're not talking chump change here.
Yeah. By the late 1990s, Tim was making a shit ton of money, and his career and his finances were flourishing. His marriage was not, and he divorced Joan. With all that money he earned, in 2001, he founded Obsidian Enterprises, and he actually hires his ex-brother-in-law, Jeff Osler, to be his vice president. Now, here's the thing about Obsidian. Obsidian was sort of the veneer of it was fancy. It was very fake it till you make it. It was like, I gotta look successful, dress successful, I want the illusion of having money. In his mind, it meant that people would trust you. They would want to work with you. If you have that much money and you're that lavish, I definitely want to work with you because I want to have that too. And he was super flashy with his money.
Durham hires a tailor to make custom-made suits for everyone in Obsidian's office. At Christmas, everyone gets a Rolex. If the point is to create a halo effect around Durham and Obsidian, it works.
Joey, this man reminds me of a chump change version of my dad, or my dad is the chump change version of him.
Yeah.
I am really tapping into my father drama. My dad loved to splash around his money like that, and which is why he lost it all, because he committed tax evasion. But it's like everything I learned from my dad and Enron is in this episode.
You know, there was a man, I can't think of who it was. Oh, it was the director of Rent, who said to me, you know, son, if you wear a suit, people will open a door for you. And I was like, what? He's like, no, it's true. If you walk into any space in a suit, people immediately look at you differently.
Yeah.
And it is true. There is something about that.
Well, it was sort of like when we covered the crappy accountant for our live show.
Yeah.
She did the same thing. She looked fancy. She dressed a fancy car, lived in a fancy house that she couldn't afford because it's that image. They're yeah. selling an image.
Yeah. Well, Tim eventually opens up a sister company called Obsidian Capital Partners, which gave an opportunity essentially for rich folks to invest their money in deals that Tim was making. And that also became very successful as the rich folks of Indianapolis were like, yes, please, and thank you. So in 2002, Tim makes himself a highfalutin deal. He purchases stock in an Indianapolis cell phone distributor called BrightPoint.
I don't know. There's so much money jargon that I just don't understand what they're saying. I know I should, and I'm good with money, but all of this checks and accounts and stocks and, you know, bitcoins, and I don't know when we started eating money, but I don't know. And then he says he made about $30 to $40 million on his investment, to which I think to myself, I'm just a regular person. But isn't there a big old difference between $30 million and $40 million? Like, how are you ballparking $10 million? I understand 30 to 32 or something, but you're unclear about $10 million?
I mean, I think it's just the kind of guy Tim is. Oh, I don't
right.
know, 30, 40, 50,
yeah,
2,000
exactly.
Million. I made 2,000 million.
Yeah.
And so we're not dealing with a humble man here. He's very much giving Trump. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
At the end of the day, when I breathe my last breath, I'd like to be worth more than anyone else in the world.
Statements like this rub many people the wrong way, says reporter Daniel Comiskey.
You know, in the Midwest, we tend to be humble. When we have money, we don't want people to know it. He was none of those things.
Durham offers no apologies for his bold ambition.
Who needs that much money? Also, that's not a goal. Like, that's just weird. He said, I want to be the richest man in the world. And then he heard people gave him pushback. And he was like,
I don't give a fuck. I don't give a fuck.
He did not care. He's
no.
like, this is what I want to do. It's gross. I just think it's gross. You're not doing anything.
You don't need that much money unless you're going to take it and funnel it into education, ending world hunger. You know, I mean, this man is putting the greed in American greed.
Yeah.
I mean, he said, I want to be a billionaire.
And in that same interview we saw from 2007, he basically compares himself to Michael Jordan and says that Michael Jordan doesn't wake up and want to be mediocre. mediocre. He wants to be the best at something. Sir, I am happy you have money. I am happy you buy people suits and Rolexes. But please do not compare a lifetime of dedication and mastering a sport to knowing how to move money around. It's just not the same. I actually was a huge Michael Jordan fan growing up. I mean, he won 6 NBA championships, 5 MVP awards. But here's the thing. I'm sorry, I'm going off topic, but he compares himself to Michael Jordan, right? When Michael Jordan was like younger, he wasn't even really that good in college. Like he wasn't even the best player on his college team. He would be in the gym by himself playing basketball basically till his feet couldn't take it anymore.
Wow.
Hours and hours. He was so competitive. And even his coaches in college were like, you're too inconsistent for the NBA. You're not going to make it. And he was like, watch me. I'm like, sir, you are not Michael Jordan. Okay, you might have his shoes. Maybe you have a million of them, but like, you're just a fucking basic dude who wants a lot of stuff.
There's a lot to be said for hard work. I had a friend who was in the core of the ballet over at ABT, and they were gonna do Swan Lake, and she really wanted to be the swan, right? But you had to be like the white swan and the black swan.
Right.
And so she just rehearsed like crazy, but she was up against so much, and she like drove herself crazy. She was in the rehearsal space rehearsing nonstop. I remember like the pianist left because he was like, I have a life, you work too hard.
Yeah.
And then she started scratching her back and like,
oh, God,
she started
hallucinating.
Yeah, she was hallucinating.
You should make that into a movie.
They
I feel
should.
Like.
She was like pulling feathers out of her back and she was ripping her toes off and then she ended up stabbing herself. But you know what? She was perfect.
Yeah. Good story.
The self-styled Michael Jordan of leveraged buyouts goes on a spending spree in the early 2000s. He buys up nitty-gritty companies, including a rubber recycler in Mississippi.
Look, I'm all for recycling. I'm just not sure that we should be recycling used condoms because that doesn't sound quite right or hygienic.
My love. No, it's like rubber, like tires, like things that, like rubber, like industrial rubber. Do you want to leave that in the episode or do you want to?
That makes more sense.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, and so... He buys more and more companies, but in 2002, brother-in-law and vice president Jeff Osler tells him about a business called Fair Finance in Akron, Ohio.
I actually am such an asshole because when I heard that name, I was like, I'm going to go out on a limb and say anybody who wants to put the word fair in the title of their company is projecting. But it actually turns out that it was the owner's last name. I was like, okay, Ellen, you don't have to get on everybody's case all of the time. Note taken, everyone. Thank you.
It's not a flashy, super exciting business, but it could be a very profitable one. Fair had done it for many, many decades.
To buy consumer debt on a large scale, Fair Finance needs lots of cash. It gets it from individual investors who buy Fair Finance investment certificates.
Which you can hang next to your It's Wine O'Clock sign in the kitchen. It's a win-win.
Well, a lot of people that invested in Fair Finance were retired, like this one man that we meet, Harold Crawford. He was a retired fireman, and his father had been investing in Fair Finance since 1936, and he's the one who recommended it to his son. And we also meet another family who invested for the long game. These are people that built trust. When you have a money person that you trust, that goes so far. So it was like a generational company that the investors were getting dividends, they were getting returns on their investments. It was all very above board. We meet Donna Emel and Jane Kalina, and her father, Herman Nussbaum, he had also been investing since like the mid-1960s. These were all working class people that when they had a little bit of extra money, they would invest it. That's what people do. People are always planning for their future, for the future of their kids, or God forbid something awful happens. These are all hardworking people. But here's the thing. Fair Finance had built the trust with these people.
And they were very honest. They were very forthcoming people. The business was on the up and up. I mean, they even had a former nun who was investing.
Yeah. Barb, I didn't know you could retire from being a nun or graduate and be like, God, we good?
Yeah.
I don't want to wear this outfit anymore, but I love ya.
It's a little hot here in Akron for this habit.
Yeah.
I'm also like, oh God, where is this going? Don't bring the nuns into this. They've been through enough. Well, she was investing her extra money, Barb, the former nun.
Yeah. And she was a nanny and she's like, I didn't have much and I was a little behind in my financial goals because, you know, when you become a nun, do you have nuns like in your religion?
No, we
religion?
Don't.
Okay. So in Catholicism, there's nuns and, you know, you take a vow of poverty.
Yeah.
You give away like your worldly possessions and everything. So when Barb peaced out from God, she was like, I don't have much. I need to get on this investment train. She worked so hard and she had in savings $125,000. That's a lot of money. And she worked really hard for that savings.
Yeah, not bad for somebody who used to be married to Jesus.
And the reason I went with Fair Finance, my Uncle Joe knew Mr. Ray Fair, and everyone, including my uncle, loved him. They said he was a wonderful man, very honest. And he said, Barb, I think you should do this.
In 2002, Tim Durham buys Fair Finance from Donald Fair, who is Ray's son. And when he acquires it, like we said earlier, it was trusted, but they were known for their transparency, you know?
This wasn't in the episode, but the Fair family handed it over to Tim, and Tim was like, I will handle the transfer. Don't even worry. I'll do a whole thing. I'm your new CEO. They did such a good job. He did not make that announcement. The investors had no idea that Fair Finance had changed ownership. Put a pin in that.
They didn't know for 3 years, girl. That is bad business. So at this point, Tim has opened yet another business called Durham Cochran Investments that he opened with a man named James Cochran, and it's through this company that he buys Fair Finance. In 2007, Tim was doing interviews for local and national media outlets, and he used this as an opportunity to flash his extremely bad taste. I'm sorry. Lavish lifestyle.
Honey, it's like Countess Luann said.
Money can't buy your class.
It's true.
It is true.
You can have a lot of money and no taste.
Yep. So we meet Daniel Kaminsky, who is the deputy editor of Indianapolis Monthly. He says most of the moguls that he would call up and try to interview were very low profile and were like, nah, I ain't talking to you. But Tim jumped at the opportunity.
Right. And so this documentary film crew comes to his $6 or $7 million yacht, and he's so vapid. He's showing off his Playboy bunny girlfriend. He's just showing all of his stuff. Like, I just want to be like, does that make you happy?
Girl,
like, not worrying makes me happy. I like decorating my house. That makes me happy. What does that do for you?
Golden Girls makes me happy.
Yeah.
A little butt stuff before Golden Girls.
Okay.
And maybe after makes me happy.
The Obsidian costs $5,000 a month just to dock. And it burns 250 gallons of gasoline per hour.
I believe that yacht had 7 bedrooms. And every bedroom had its own bathroom with beautiful tile work and, glass stairs lit from below up to the upper deck.
I'm sorry. Everything about this man screams, my dick ain't no bigger than a little chicken beak.
Yeah.
And to that I say,
eeny, weeny, teeny, weeny, shriveled little short, short man. Don't want.
Like, get out of here with that teeny little dick.
Another thing, this reminded me of my dad. He tipped everyone in like $100 bills. Just the guy docking the boat, the guy opening the door. I mean, I don't think my dad tipped hundreds, but like, it's just flashy. And it's like, look at me, look at my money, look at my little D. I need 2 extra therapies because of this episode.
Yeah, this man is the definition of the ick. So for his next trick, Tim gives CNBC a tour of his 12,000 square foot mansion in Indianapolis. The narrator says,
Chateau Durham has wallpaper on the ceilings and fine art on the walls.
Fine art? He has a painting of a Rolls Royce on the wall that looks like something that should be hanging in the bathroom of a Johnny Rockets. The fuck? Then we see a series of 6 paintings done by Peter Max in the style of Andy Warhol, all of Tim in a fucking suit with a bunch of color splashed around it. It looks like his profile pic from LinkedIn and someone made art out of it. And I use the term art very loosely.
Do you know my ex-husband used to represent Peter Max?
Really?
He's such a hack. He basically takes prints and throws some paint on it and calls it an original.
He's the Jackson Pollock of modern art.
No, I mean, least Jackson Pollock, it was all art. He would take like a poster and then splash some paint and be like, that's an original, no two are alike. He was a huge like schemer in like the 90s and 2000s. He used to represent him. He used to sell his artwork.
Well, that tracks.
Yeah.
So at this point, it's very clear that Tim is an egomaniac. Not just that, he knows he is, and yeah. He does not give a fiddler's fuck about it.
No. Not at all. You guys, what's happening? He had a car collecting obsession. He had to build a 2-story, 20-car garage to fit all of his cars. I'll bet he didn't have a McDonald's car.
Yeah.
This is, I can't. My father trauma is so triggered. He calls his cars his kids. No, those are not kids. They do not talk back. They do not need 3 meals a day. They do not outgrow their shoes every 6 months. They do not text you in the middle of the night and say, I don't like you. Lola did that yesterday. Those are not your kids. Okay, they're cars, they're automobiles. If you're a motorist, you can say that, but that's the only time you can say that.
I'm never going to live down motorist, am I?
No, never. It's that's going to honestly feed my soul for about 6 to 8 months.
Business days.
Yeah.
So this short-dicked wonder has a $1.8 million Bugatti. Why? He says, if I lose the keys, it costs $5,000 to replace.
My dick is so small.
And I mean, for $1.8 million, Mr. Bugatti himself better open up that motherfucking car door for me every morning, noon, and night. When I enter it, when I exit. Who's that? Oh, who's opening the door? That's Bugatti. Mr. Bugatti. I paid him what? A cool $1.8 million. If you wink at him, he'll shine your shoes too. Okay.
It's just, it's so much. And not in the good way. We're so much in the fun way. At least I think we are. Do you guys love us? Okay.
While Durham works hard to craft public perception, some insiders at Obsidian are growing concerned about his spending. Jeff Osler, once Durham's brother-in-law and senior vice president at Obsidian, says Durham can blow $100,000 a day in Las Vegas.
He's like, hey, Tim, can we talk just for like a couple minutes? I just wanted to like, can we talk about your spending a little bit? I feel like it might, I know it's not my place. It might be a little bit out of control. And Tim's like, oh, what are you talking about? He's like, I don't know. Like the other day you spent $100,000 in Las Vegas in one day. Are we making enough money for this? And he's like, yeah, we're fine. In fact, I want to buy some restaurants, some nightclubs, some magazines. Oh, and you know the National Lampoon's franchise, I want to buy that too.
What the fuck? It's so weird. This man's offices were on the top floor of the Chase Building, which was the highest building in Indianapolis. It was gigantic. It was ornate. And the crazy thing is they didn't need all that space. They had like 2 people working in there and a secretary.
Yeah. Really did. It was just the image. You need the image. You need the flashy shit, right? It was all a facade. So back to his really oddly planned, uneventful 44th birthday. It was a whole weekend. Okay. You know, I don't even like birthdays. The thought of someone celebrating their birthday all weekend makes me break out in hives. But basically, they outfitted his house to be like the Playboy Mansion. And this party was fashioned after Hugh's famous parties with the body art painting, the models, the big tittied beauties everywhere. And it was a pajama party, but everyone was naked.
They painted pajamas on these poor models. Yeah. My Lord. They had paint in places no one should have paint.
And they had all of the celebrities there were like so D-list. They were below D-list. There's a picture with Kato Kaelin. Like, how do you even make that list? They're like, you know who I'd love to have at my party? What's the name of that guy that testified in the OJ trial? Kato Kaelin? Yeah, Kato Kaelin.
Get him here.
Yeah, get him to Indianapolis, stat.
You buy everyone a Rolex for Christmas and the best celebrity you could get was Kato Kaelin? That man doesn't even make it to the middle of the alphabet with his celebrity status. Give me a break. So, Playboy Playmate Megan Houseman is back to save.
There was just, all the girls were just there to have a good time. We were just drinking, you know, obviously there was several open bars. And we were kind of just looked at by the local Indiana residents. Like, where did these girls come from?
These men were going goo goo gaga over these women with their pajamas painted on their fucking vaginas.
And she goes over all the other tacky things at the party. Do you know what my least favorite thing was?
Was it the handing out of the $100 bills to anyone and everyone?
No, it was the cake of the $1 million bill with his face on it. You know I hate anything with our face on it, right? Whenever we're doing merch, I'm like, nope, I don't want my face on that. Nope, don't put our faces on that. You're gonna be like, I couldn't possibly serve my guests cake unless my face is on it.
Yeah,
take it away. I don't want it. I want my face on it.
This all tracks. This man is garbage. He was literally handing out $100 bills like he was giving people a free Coke slushy to go get at the 7-Eleven. This man's dick is shrinking by the minute. Pretty soon he will have a vagina.
Yeah. It's so true.
So by 2008, Tim has moved to Los Angeles. Of course he has. He buys a $3 million house in the hills, and he also rents a gigantic mansion for a cool $25,000 a month. But don't worry, he keeps his mansion in Indiana, even though he don't particularly care for Indiana.
He's like, I need to commemorate the place where I had the cake with my face on it. I can't give that away. So now he's moved on to a new girlfriend, not a Playboy model, but a penthouse model. Her name was Erica Taylor. Now, let's go back to that National Lampoon
movie properties, like,
yeah. So in December 17th, 2008, his partner
December 17th, 2008, 8 days before Christmas. Thank you, Jesus.
Honestly, that is my bad. Like, God. I'm actually genuinely sorry.
Thank you.
I don't know what came over me.
Did you not learn anything from I Almost Got Away With It?
I actually did not.
On December 17th, 2008, Durham's friend and business partner in Lampoon, Dan Lakin, steps down as the company's CEO after he's indicted for allegedly manipulating its stock price.
Very Enron. And he's facing jail time. And he's like, okay. Wait. Before you put me in jail, I got a story for you.
Actually, we have the audio of what he said when the FBI told him he was facing jail time. Can you roll that, Rick?
Let me tell you something. Wait.
I love that audio.
Yep, he has a story to tell. Enter Special Agent Dennis Haladin, who is the lead investigator for the FBI on this case. And he tells us that Dan claimed Tim was financing his lavish lifestyle through Fair Finance in Akron, Ohio. Again, that's that company that all of those middle-class working folks in Ohio were investing their money in. Apparently, Tim had taken out, wait for it, $100 million in loans from Fair Finance, and the 5,000 people who were investing had no idea.
They had no idea it was even sold. Remember, he was like, don't worry. We're gonna hand it over. No, they felt safe with Fair Finance, and they loved that company. They felt respected. They felt part of something. They watched their wealth grow together. So why on earth would Tim want to break that trust, right? It's so much so that Herman Neubaum, he was in for $170,000 with Fair Finance. He was a retired farmer. He worked his whole life, and he trusted the company so much that he put all of his dividends, he invested it back in the company. And the family was like, I mean, Dad, do you maybe want to diversify? And he's like, nope, Fair Finance has always been good to me. I'm going to stick with them, which I get. Stick with what you know. Stick with who you trust. And that was something that is so important in the finance business. When you run an honest, good business model, that just makes people be loyal to you. It's the easiest model to follow.
It's true.
Be honest, be good, be transparent, and people will be loyal to you.
Yep, and that's who the Fair family was. Sadly, that's not who Tim Durham was.
Around the same time that Dan Lakin talks to the FBI, Greg Andrews, editor of the Indianapolis Business Journal, gets a call from an anonymous source. This deep throat tells much the same story as Dan Lakin, that Tim Durham is plundering Fair Finance.
He is treating it like it's his own bank, and he could just take money from it whenever and use it however. And he was funneling it into any and all of his businesses. And the thing about loans is, I don't know if you know this.
Oh, no, tell me. I actually love learning money stuff. So anything you can impart on me is appreciated.
I have a big brain. The thing about loans, they're a loan that you have to pay back. That's the whole point of a loan.
You have to, what do you have to, you have to give the money back?
So you take the money out of the cookie jar and you go, I owe you. And then you write I owe you on like some, like a really pretty letterhead.
Right.
And then you put it in there and you could sign it like Love Ellen if you want. And then you take that money and then you use it for whatever you need it for. And then when you get that money back, you put it back in and you take out the I owe you and you just write a letter that says thanks.
Right.
And put it in the cookie jar.
Because if you don't do that, that's stealing. That's how money works.
Here at I Think Not, we teach you ethics.
So, yeah. So tell your friends, if you want a finance podcast, we're the one for you.
Fuck you, Wall Street Journal. I'm a wizard. So this man was using that money to live large, and it made him look like a mogul. He wasn't a mogul.
No.
He wasn't a good businessman.
So because of this anonymous call and because of the information Dan provided to the FBI, they were like, let's just do a really quick, really casual demi-subpoena. Let's just subpoena his bank records. And the bank records corroborated everything that Dan and the anonymous caller said. $90 million had been shuffled around from a company in Ohio. So this is a big crime. This is stealing. Your cookie jar is fucked.
Yeah, this is not like me in Mexico when I accidentally used Big Mouth and Blue Eyes PayPal to pay for a sarong and I had to pay it back. No. That's not how this works. So we hit fall of 2009. The FBI taps Tim's phones and they're listening around the clock, especially when Tim talks to Fair Finance Chairman Jim Cochran and the Chief Financial Officer Rick Snow. Now, Indianapolis Business General had published a piece by editor Greg Andrews after he received that anonymous tip on what Tim was doing. And now investors in Fair Finance are freaking the fuck out. Rightfully so. They know their money is essentially funding Tim's small dick car collection. And now the FBI is listening on conversations with Tim, Jim, and Rick about how they're going to keep the truth about Fair Finance from investors.
Yeah, most of the big time investors that have 200 plus thousand, I've had lots of conversations with.
Jim Cochran is Durham's point man in Ohio. These days, he's answering anxious questions from investors.
Most have asked directly, you know, have you taken money and used it to your own benefit, our money, investors' money? Of course I said no.
So now they are point blank lying.
Using your money for houses? How dare you? Using your money for Bukkake cars? Absolutely not. Painting models in pajama? That sounds... You sound crazy right now. You sound crazy. Okay, Meemaw. Yeah, I had a party where I painted naked women to look like they had clothes. Are you off your meds?
Yeah, like, I mean, they gaslit the fuck out of people.
Yeah. So naturally, this is what happens. People pass away, an investor dies, and the estate is owed that money. And they're like, don't worry, we're not going to give it to them. They're not going to reinvest with us anyway. They're not a customer anymore. What the hell do we care? These people were being so cavalier with their phone calls. They just gave themselves away. And the FBI is tip, tip, tapping onto those phones, listening to every word and recording every confession that they don't even know that they're making.
Yo, the truth is Tim Durham is out of money. And so is Fair Finance. And now Tim is trying to raise more money from investors because shit is falling apart. He needs $250 million to cover his debt. But to be able to even attempt to raise that money, he needs approval from Ohio regulators. So Tim, Jim, and Rick, stupid fucking names.
Hi, we're Tim, Jim, and Rick. And have you heard of us? Yeah, Tim, Jim, and Rick. Yeah, well, we don't paint pajamas on clitorises. This is not what we do. These cars? No, it's not. We are Tim, Jim, and Rick, and we're honest guys. Tim, Jim, and Rick.
That was a great commercial, honestly. It ran during General Hospital.
Come to the law offices of Tim, Jim, and Rick. So they try to pull, you know, a ton of documents and present a solid case for themselves. And they're just joking about, oh, this shouldn't be a problem because the state regulator that we're dealing with, he ain't too bright.
My feeling is give them a shitload more information
so that there's just so much it overwhelms the guy. My guess is the guy at the state of Ohio isn't a financial genius.
Yeah, no, I think you're right.
Meanwhile, while Tim, Jim, and Rick are trying to get their boy band off the ground, the FBI is in Ohio building their case against them, collecting all the records, all the receipts, all the phone calls.
Show me the receipts!
Yeah. And then Fair Finance is like, you know, we need to build a little bit of confidence in our investors and get more investors. You know what would be great? I think we should make like a really cute commercial. And what do you think? Don't you think that would get more investors?
Fucking Mo, Larry, and Curly here ain't got two brain cells to rub together. Here at Fair Finance, Tim, Jim, and Rick are fighting for your money. We did not have a Playboy Mansion themed party. We weren't giving out $100 bills or looking like small dicked assholes, even though now our dicks have turned into uteri.
It was a great jingle, honestly.
3300 Empire. People hate that commercial and I love it.
So they now make a new business model and they present that to their investors. They're like, okay, this is what we're doing now. All right, hear me out. Does everyone have their hearing aids on? Alma, check your battery. Okay, this is what we're doing. We're loaning out money. No questions at the end. We're loaning out money to businesses. And then so we have the money and then they're going to pay us back. These are valuable assets. Okay. That's all you need to know. These conversations, like everything about these men just scream caveman. They're like,
aha, we fool people, buy boats. Look at us.
It is so disrespectful. And it is just, when you look at it from the outside, it's like, how did you ever think you were going to get away with this?
Oh my God. These idiots. Let me tell you something. Their places in hell are secured. They are sure. The devil himself, he's like, yeah, I've got extra gasoline draws for you. You're really fucking mean. And so you have to remember, a lot of these investors are people who don't make a lot of money, but the extra money they do make, they put into Fair Finance, including that former nun, Barb.
No.
Whose entire life savings of $125,000 is invested in this company. Barb called Fair Finance.
I had wanted to take some money out to redo the kitchen because it really needed it and lots of things in the house. And the lady said, oh, it'll take a few weeks. I said, that's fine. Well, it never happened.
So that brings us to November 24th, 2009.
Mm-hmm.
And they get...
What are you missing?
What am I missing?
55 days before Christmas. I'm sorry. I'm going to let this bit go now. I'm putting it to bed. I'm sorry.
Okay. Don't ever stop. Maybe the people will want you to stop, but I don't want you to stop. So they acquire a search warrant to check out the headquarters at Obsidian Enterprises. So tons of FBI. They just start combing Obsidian's office and they shut that shit down. They're just like, we got this, all of that ornate, ugly furniture. We're taking that too.
And then they go into Akron, Ohio and they shut down Fair Finance. And it was a very dark day for the people of Akron, as they realize that their life savings, their nest eggs, they're gone. So on March 16th, 2011, Tim Durham, Jim Cochran, and Rick Snow are all indicted on conspiracy to commit fraud, wire fraud, and securities fraud. And in June 2012, all three men go to trial. And Tim says, yeah, you know those phone calls you recorded? The FBI really was just listening in at a bad time. I was struggling.
Yeah. Hello? Do you know how much gas my boats take? Okay. I was in a financial crisis. My 20 cars have to be clean. Like, I don't understand why you don't understand how challenging and difficult my life is. That Bukkake car, those tires aren't going to rotate themselves.
Yeah, someone's got to pay Mr. Bugatti.
I keep calling it Bukkake.
Bukkake.
Special Agent Hallerdin says
Fair Finance was broke. He was running a Ponzi scheme in the traditional sense. If he didn't have new investors coming in the door with cash in hand, it would not be possible for him to pay his bills. That's the traditional Ponzi.
So he took out $144 million in loans from Fair Finance for himself and his friends and family that he was giving loans to. He was never going to make that money back. He was never going to be able to pay that money back in a lifetime. So on top of that, you told your investors who trusted you that the loans were somehow assets. You are not struggling.
Yeah.
You are a cum rag at best. And we're about to set that cum rag on fire. Just go with me with this metaphor.
Okay. Yeah. I didn't know where that was going, but I'm...
Death to the cum rag!
I'm prepared to support you.
Burn the cum rag!
And he's still kind of like bullshitting. He's like, these are loans. I'm going to pay it back. What are you talking about? So in June 20th, all the guys are found guilty and the victims are all there. They're making statements. These are elderly people who have been left in financial ruin. Some of them can't even afford their medication.
Yeah, it's disgusting. And now former nun Barb says, this broke my heart.
I know what you're going to say.
She says, I have to babysit kids until the day I go and meet Jesus. Literally, because I only get $102 in Social Security, and that doesn't even cover my electric bill. That broke my heart because no one deserves to have their future robbed of them in that way. And also, don't get me started on Social Security. $102.
Yeah. They all lost everything. Herman Nussbaum, he has since passed, and his daughters were so sweet. They were like, you know what? He lost his money, and that rich bottom of the garbage can man, you know, he might have had money and fancy cars and properties and everything, but guess what my dad had? My dad had integrity.
Yeah.
And he had a life well lived. And that's something that piece of shit will never have, which I love that for them. But also just middle class people who are just living a humble life. They were farmers, firemen, serving other people. They're not saving to go paint pajamas on big fake tittied women. They're literally saving to contribute to their kids' college funds.
Yes.
Or take their grandkids on a fucking cruise. You know, it's really heartbreaking.
It really is. Well, Rick Snow gets 10 years in prison. James Cochran gets 25 years. And Tim Durham gets a whopping 50 years in jail. Rot.
Yeah.
Now, Jane Kalina, Herman Nussbaum's daughter, says, I watched him as he was escorted out of court in his prison uniform, handcuffs. And she says,
I just would like to ask him, was it worth it? Where you are now, was it really? Would you do it again?
So, by 2014, that enormous mansion that Tim owned in Indianapolis, it's fallen apart.
Good.
They have squatters living in there.
Good. I hope that they saved a shit ton of rent and they just lived for free there for years.
It finally sold for a little over $2 million, and that is bupkis compared to what Tim spent on it. So Tim lost everything, literally everything. But the problem is that there's so much debt involved here that even selling everything off, there's not enough capital left over to reimburse investors. That car collection of Tim's?
Yeah.
Most of those cars were leased and very few owned outright. Most of them had debt on them.
Exactly.
So his whole life was a farce. He was a certifiable con man, most likely with a 2-inch penis.
Yeah. And they're like, all right, we sold everything. We do have these pop art pieces with that guy's ugly mug on it. Can I pay someone to take these, actually? I'll give you $5. The frame is worth it. Okay. Yeah. Take the frame out of here with this guy's ugly face.
What a piece of shit. Well, side note, Tim was disbarred in 2016 by the Indiana Supreme Court. And in 2014, two counts of wire fraud were actually overturned because the U.S. Court of Appeals in Chicago failed to enter important documentary evidence into trial record.
I hate that when there's just some kind of a technicality that gets crooks off. I mean, it is. It's part of our judicial system and fuck ups happen, but it was a technicality.
Yep.
It was like a missing piece of paperwork.
Well, in 2022, this piece of shit, he may not have a penis anymore, but he's got balls the size of fucking Russia. He made a plea to shorten his prison sentence, but the judge rejected it, and Tim will stay in prison until 2055.
Freaking good. Look at you with your side research.
Yeah. Well, it's just such a tragic ending for these people because, you know, he's going to rot in jail, but like these people's livelihoods, people who work their entire life to save a nest egg. So like you said, so they could take their families on vacations and enjoy their golden years. They've been robbed of that. That poor fucking nun has to babysit kids that sneeze Cheetos literally until the day she dies.
I know. It's so sad.
It's so odd to think of someone who has lived this kind of lifestyle, who is now in a cell in a federal prison for probably for the rest of his life. I mean, it's from the highest high to the lowest low in just a period of a couple of years. It's a classic American story in some ways.
Covering this show makes me have a different take, because sometimes on cases with Rabia and Ellen, I'll say like, oh, but if it were financial crimes, I'll say something like that. Like if we're talking about murder and someone gets like a high sentence or a low sentence. And really, just from watching, we're only two episodes in. It's very heartbreaking. Putting faces to the names of people who lose everything that they genuinely spend their life building. And listen, it's just money. I get it. Money comes, money goes. That's not what's important. It's just disrespectful for people who just live their lives authentically and simply. And that's what we're taught. We're taught you work hard for a certain amount of time, then you get old and you get to take a break.
Yeah.
That's your gift. You get to take a break and you get to go on cruises to St. Thomas or do whatever you want.
Yeah.
And these elderly people, poor ex-nun Babs, yeah, she's taking care of little Connor and Hayden over there. It's just, it's really awful. Was it worth it, sir? Was it worth it for your little tiny eggplant emoji to be stroked a bunch of times and talk about all your cars being your kids? Like, you're nobody.
And
you're
now
absolutely a nobody.
And you're gonna die in jail.
Yeah, enjoy that. Have fun. I'm sure your tiny penis will serve you well. Say something funny.
Well, I think, because I am a smart businesswoman, I think that in America, we should make a law that when any man wants to start a business, that we have to measure their penis first.
Mm-hmm.
Because if it's too small, they're most likely going to do corrupt things. But if it's large, we know that most likely they'll start a podcast with their best friend and watch Golden Girls at night.
Wait a minute. Thank you, Down Bitches, for joining us for American Greed. Thanks for listening. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for cleaning your kitchens with us. Thanks for waiting while your kids are at soccer practice with us. Anything that you do, we are just happy. Don't forget to join us on the Patreon. By the time this airs, we will have already been to Columbus and Indianapolis. We love you, Columbus and Indianapolis.
Yeah, we do. We can't wait to see you. And make sure that after the show, you stay around and hug us and kiss us and take a picture. It's our favorite part of the night.
Well, not Columbus and Indianapolis, because we've already been there, but for the other cities that we are going to, which is Nashville on June 4th, Phoenix on June 16th, and Minneapolis on June 17th, you can come and hug our faces. Go to ithinknotpod.com and click the See Us Live link. I promise you, you won't regret it. And just so you know, our merch boxes for the next quarter, we're giving you guys some extra time so that you can see what we're doing here. So those will close at the end of this week. So head on over to Patreon if that tickles your fancy or suits your financial needs. No matter what, we are just happy that you're here. Be sure and follow us on social media.
Yeah, you can follow us on all platforms at I Think Not Pod. You can also join our Facebook group where we have a lot of fun. You can stay up to date on our announcements. And that is called the I Think Not Podcast Facebook discussion group. You can also connect with other DBs. We have a good time over there. We have our Small Business Saturdays once a month. It's just a great place to have a little extra fun.
Yeah, we sure do love that you're here, and we love you, and I love you, Joey.
I love you, DBs, and I love you too, Yellen Marsh.
I love you, Dumb Bitches.
Love you.
Bye.
Oh, fuck you, Tim Gavin.
Balls the size of fucking Tahiti. Why Tahiti? Why Tahiti? This is not like me in This is not like me in... Where the fuck did I go? Okay.
So that brings us to November 24th, 2008. And they get a search...
I think it's 9.
Do you think there's somebody checking?
Oh, I didn't know we needed to be accurate on our dates for a true crime podcast.
No. You think there's somebody like, that was 2009!